from KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the film High Noon, the marshal Will Kane, played by Gary Cooper, is walking the streets of town looking for someone to help him fight the bad guys. The journalist Glenn Frankel has a new book about the making of the film, and he says Will Kane's search is for the meaning of his life. He's always assumed certain things, that people will stand together to fight evil, but Frankel says Kane is on a journey into the unfaithful heart of his community, and in the end, everyone turns away from him in his hour of need. The film is a parable, an allegory of what was happening at the time. The country was gripped by fear of communists, there were blacklists, people were naming names. Today in the program, Glenn Frankel is joining us to talk about High Noon, a story about courage in the face of fear. Join us after the news.
On the next More to Say, the story of Madison Jensen.
She was the one that whatever Dad wanted to do, she was in your back pocket. Whenever we would go duck hunting, fishing, she was going.
Madison died in a Utah jail. In fact, more inmates die in Utah jails than any other state. KUER's Whitney Evans has been trying to find out why. Download the story now, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Many of you know the story of the 1952 movie High Noon. The marshal, Will Kane, played by Gary Cooper, of course, is getting ready to retire. He's just gotten married. But a very nasty man he sent to prison has just gotten out, and he's arriving in town on the train at, well, at noon. And he has a gang of fellow bad guys, and he wants revenge. Kane goes around the town asking for help, but no one does. And in that last scene, you'll remember he's completely alone. In his book, the journalist Glenn Frankel explains that the man who came up with this idea for the story, Carl Foreman, at first conceived of it as a hopeful parable. But then he surveyed the climate of fear at the time, particularly in Hollywood, where people were naming names and drawing up blacklists of supposed communist sympathizers. And Frankel says Foreman's vision for the movie began to darken. So High Noon became about the moral and political collapse of a community in the face of fear. Today in the program, Glenn Frankel is joining us to talk about the backstory of this now iconic movie. The book is High Noon, The Hollywood Blacklist and the Making of an American Classic. Glenn Frankel was a staff writer at the Washington Post for some 27 years, during which time he won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting. He's the author of a number of books, and he's joining us today from his home in Arlington, Virginia. Glenn Frankel, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
I guess I wanted to begin with the basics. When did you first start looking into this story? When did you start getting interested in this?
Well, I sort of stumbled into it. I mean, I had just done a book about John Ford's classic Western, The Searchers, starring John Wayne. Yeah. And I was at the University of Texas at Austin, and the School of Journalism was part of a college that included the film studies department. And we did a little film series, and I did Searchers, and a professor at film studies did High Noon. And I'd always loved High Noon, but I hadn't thought deeply about it. I knew it was loosely connected to the Hollywood Blacklist and the Red Scare era. Came out in 1952, was made in 1951. But he drew all the connections and also made the case for High Noon being a great movie. And when that was over, I thought to myself, well, first of all, do you want to be a movie book writer? It seems doing one was one thing, but doing another really would put you in that genre.
Right.
But then, I mean, The Blacklist is such a rich and turbulent era in our history, and there's so many, you know, unresolved questions about it. That, you know, it just was rich territory. And once I determined that no one had actually approached it from this kind of angle, you know, taking a great movie like High Noon and narrating the process of creation and how that was affected by the Blacklist, it was irresistible. So I was very lucky in that sense to have stumbled upon it.
You say in the book that each generation has read into High Noon its own politics, its own values. So how much of this was inspired by what you were seeing? You know, this kind of neo-populist movement today, did that inspire the way you were thinking about this?
Well, you know, I started on this in 2013, and it was long before the obvious contours of the Trump ascendancy, you might say. But the Tea Party was out there. It was a neo-populist movement. It was you know, feasting on the anxieties and the disaffection of a large group of people who felt not only voiceless, but also felt like the country was being taken away from them by outsiders. You know, back then, I think it was this Muslim president from Kenya they were, you know, banging on about. And the targets have changed over time. But that had a lot of resonance in looking back to the Blacklist era, because that's another time of great disaffection, great political anxiety. We think of the 1950s as this, you know, tranquil era where white men ruled. But in fact, it was anything but tranquil. The anxieties of the Cold War, the beginning of the, 50-year, 40-year nuclear arms race with the Soviet Union. All these things were out there, and so it was very resonant.
You point out that for the time, the fear of communism was exaggerated for sure, but it wasn't entirely groundless. Talk a little bit about that part, that there was some reason for people to be, I mean, kind of freaked out, but it just went overboard.
Well, there were plenty of reasons to be concerned. I mean, our great ally, the Soviet Union, who had helped us win World War II and played a pivotal role, you know, as soon as the war was over, for a variety of reasons, we found ourselves in conflict with the Soviet Union and the Soviet Empire and our empire, if you will. So you've got that new global rivalry. You've got, as I suggested earlier, you know, nuclear weapons become involved quite quickly. We have our A-bomb, but they get their A-bomb. And they get it in part because they had help from some spies, the Rosenbergs and others who had helped them get the technology they needed or the secrets they needed. Meanwhile, by 1951, remember, we're also in a war in Korea. More than 80,000 American soldiers had been killed or wounded fighting communists in Korea. So you have all these things thrown together. You have and though the American Communist Party was very, very small by that point and had very little traction in society, it was an obvious target for people who were looking for someone to blame, for someone to hold responsible. So you're absolutely right. I mean, there was a real basis for this concern. I mean, there were, you know, communists by and large in America felt themselves to be American patriots, and they weren't out to overthrow the government violently. I would consider them political dissidents, but their links to the Soviet Union and their sense of concern and for some of them loyalty to the Soviet Union really made them obvious targets.
There's another interesting dimension here, and we should say that some 4 years before High Noon is made, the political landscape is really interesting. Truman is in the White House, but the Republicans have both houses of Congress. And Truman, you've talked about, he's facing reelection. And really, and this is kind of ironic, I suppose, this Democratic president creates this loyalty oath. I don't know. I guess it in some ways is a way of dealing, not pandering maybe, but certainly dealing with, I guess, the sense of fear of the time.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, Truman, you remember, he comes in after FDR was president for 12 years, after FDR's death in early 1945, and he's just feeling his way. He doesn't like the House Un-American Activities Committee. He doesn't like the witch hunt. He says that their tactics were un-American. Yeah. But at the same time, the political pressure on him is intense, and he comes up with his attorney general with a loyalty oath for federal employees. And, you know, Truman, as was his successor, Dwight Eisenhower, was a bit of an enabler of all this for quite a while because he didn't have the political traction to oppose it. Things like the holding back and withdrawing of passports, the suspension of people's passports, and the refusal to issue new passports to anyone who didn't, you know, who was on various lists of so-called subversives. I mean, so the Democratic Party, I think a lot of our institutions failed us in this era, including both political parties. And Democrats, while they weren't leading the charge by any means, they weren't offering much resistance.
It's interesting you talk about also how the old guard, I guess FDR liberalism was beginning to fade. That's another twist in the political dimension of what's going on here.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And liberals are kind of caught in the middle here. It was very interesting to study their role. especially through the prism of Hollywood, because, you know, Hollywood had, as now, has a lot of liberals there. I followed a few folks I was particularly interested in. These folks, when the House Un-American Activities Committee first starts investigating Hollywood in 1947 and calls a group of communists and ex-communists to the stand who refuse to cooperate, they become known as the Hollywood Ten, incidentally. Right. Liberals, you know, a number of good liberals led by Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall and Dory Sherry, one of the studio heads, various folks, they support what was called the Committee for the First Amendment.
Yeah.
They're backing it on a civil liberties basis that, you know, political dissidence has to be allowed in our democratic system. But after the Hollywood Ten are convicted of contempt of Congress for not cooperating, and the Supreme Court upholds the conviction, liberals find themselves really trapped between this ongoing inquisition by the committee and its supporters, and at the same time, this small, secretive communist group that won't cooperate with them either, and they get caught out in the middle. I should add one more thing, which is that the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover, who is part of this inquisition, they consider liberals just as bad as communists.
Right.
Liberals, communists, Jews, for that matter, were all targeted in this thing as outsiders who were, you know, who had stolen our country and our government, and you know, there needed to be a reckoning.
It's interesting you write about. I hadn't known this part. You talk about how Jack Warner of Warner Brothers felt particularly vulnerable in the time because they had made this film called Mission to Moscow, which was, I guess you could say, it was kind of pro-Stalin for its time. This was before any of this fear. And so in some ways they were kind of backtracking and having to make up for their not necessarily support for communism, but certainly their sort of deeply embedded socialism or liberalism of the earlier time.
Well, Mission to Moscow is a fascinating curiosity because it is pro-Stalinist. It's made during the war, and FDR and people in the government encouraged Warner Brothers to do this and to do a couple. And there were a couple of other films like this during the war period where the Soviets are our allies. And so FDR and the government wants to convince the American people, you know, that they're our friends and collaborators and explain what it's about. But no question. You can see Mission to Moscow on YouTube in bits and pieces, and it's pretty appalling. I mean, it supports the show trials and finds Comrade Stalin to be this great sort of benign figure. So yeah, Jack Warner had to answer to that. He was also vulnerable, and all the studios were vulnerable in the late 40s and early 50s because the economics of movie making had changed so dramatically, and customers were finding other things to spend their leisure dollars on, and for a lot of reasons, you know, they were losing money, their profits were way down, so they felt politically vulnerable because of the culture of Hollywood, and they felt economically vulnerable because of the forces around them.
There's this group, the Motion Picture Alliance for the Preservation of American Ideals. You had people like John Wayne in the group. You had people like Ronald Reagan. I guess, ironically, Gary Cooper is in this group. Reagan, of course, was a liberal, and then he made this evolution into being a Republican and a conservative. But talk a little bit about this particular group, this conservative group in Hollywood.
It gets started in early 1944, and you mentioned some of the people behind it. Cooper was not a founder, but he signed on early. Walt Disney was involved in it. Yeah. A number of actors and directors who felt that, you know, there were commies in Hollywood, and they wanted to stand up against them, and they end up inviting the House Un-American Activities Committee to come out and study communist infiltration and investigate. They also become some of the major informers and, you know, information to the FBI in its own series of investigations. So they're the right guard. An important component of them were gossip columnists, very powerful folks. I'm talking about Luella Parsons and Hedda Hopper, but others as well, who took a very strong right-wing stand. And they are the backlash. It begins, in the mid-40s. It reaches its peak after the committee comes out to Hollywood and does its own investigations.
Let's say something about, and we'll come back to his life, but let's say something about Gary Cooper in this particular time. He didn't name names, but he would say that he thought there was some, as he told members of the committee, some communistic influence in Hollywood. Where is Gary Cooper in all of this? at that point?
That's an interesting question. He is a conservative Republican from Montana. He's a strong anti-communist, but not a very ideological guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, he had many friends in both camps. He's not kind of not like John Wayne, who we'd mentioned earlier, who is much more rigid in a sense. Cooper is one of what they called the friendly witnesses. You know, the committee first comes out in 47, and first they call people like Jack Warner and Gary Cooper and Walt Disney to sort of give them the lay of the land. And Warner and Disney do things like naming the names of people they think are communists. But Cooper doesn't do that. His testimony, he has that sort of charming insouciance.
Yeah.
And he says things like, well, I've read some scripts that I thought were kind of red-tinged, pink-tinged.
Yeah.
But when they ask him, well, could you name us one or two? He says, well, you know, I read them late at night. And, you know, if I see something there I don't like, I just throw them in the trash. I can't remember any of that. I thought it was he was trying to have it both ways. He was trying to cooperate with the committee, but at the same time not give them anything. I called it in the book his best performance of 1947.
Right. Yeah, because you say it was you couldn't tell whether Gary Cooper found all of this positive or regrettable. And I have to say, it's a question that comes up from time to time, at least for me, in the story that you tell in the book, whether or not Gary Cooper signs on to High Noon, which has this message that you could say was veiled, and in many ways it was, but did he, you know, I can't tell where he's, I'm a little baffled, I guess, that he would, this conservative Republican, sign on for a message film.
Well, it wasn't necessarily viewed as a message film at the time. I mean,
yeah.
Carl Foreman, who is subpoenaed to testify in 1951 in the middle of the film shoot, he's not telling people he's writing a blacklist parable, because
yeah.
that would have been the kiss of death. They would have killed the movie right then.
Right.
But, you know, again, you know, we talked earlier about the studios being in economic trouble in the early 50s. And Cooper was the ultimate product of the studio system. You know, he didn't direct his own movies. He didn't write his own scripts.
Yeah.
He needed good stuff. And by the early 50s, the studios, the big studios, really weren't giving him the kind of roles that he admired. So when he saw the script for High Noon, which is this beautiful, terse, you know, suspense-filled, very meaningful script, he loved it. And he agreed to do it for less than half his usual salary. He got heavily involved in it. He didn't play the big star on the set. He was a really cooperative, hardworking guy. And he and Carl Foreman, who was there as associate producer at the time, they got along really well.
Yeah.
And so for Cooper, it was a personal thing. He trusted Foreman. When Foreman came to him and said, listen, I've been subpoenaed. I was once in the Communist Party. I'm not anymore, but I'm going to have to testify. You know, if you want to walk away from this film, I'll understand. Cooper said, no, I
yeah.
trust you. I like you. I believe in you. I'm in this. Let's go on.
I have to say, I really love the part in the book that where you profile Gary Cooper as a person and as an actor. I wanted you to say something about that. He's born and raised in Helena, Montana. Really lucks out when it comes to Los Angeles. And one of the things you talk about is how he, you know, always, you mention his insouciance and his modesty, you know, portrays himself as a reluctant actor or a reluctant celebrity. But you really talk about how he plunges into wanting to be a good, credible actor.
Well, he's totally untrained. Yes, he was born in Helena, Montana. Interestingly, both his parents were British immigrants.
Yeah.
They had both come to Montana to seek their fortunes in the 1880s. They'd met there, got married, had two kids. And they're the ones who moved to L.A. originally. Mm. The father is a lawyer, and he has a big legal case down there. Cooper comes for Thanksgiving in 1924. He's, you know, 23 years old. He's unemployed. He needs work. He's not thinking about being an actor, though. He wants to be an artist. He comes for Thanksgiving, and, you know, I guess the parents' worst nightmare, he never leaves. He just
right.
stays there. But he's a tall, handsome, beautiful-looking man. Blue eyes and lashes and got that sort of gangly charm, you know. He's an authentic Westerner. And so he very quickly finds work. He can ride horses. These are real things. So he gets work in Hollywood, you know, doing stunts and riding and doing small bit roles. And within three, 4 years, He's a star. Mm-hmm. Unlike, say, John Wayne or Humphrey Bogart, who take a decade or more to build their celluloid personas, Gary Cooper is a natural, and he gets it right away. And yes, he always feels a little bit of inferiority because he has no training as an actor. He can watch some real actors that work there, and he admires them. But he's a pretty quick learner. And, you know, he's not just a cowboy star. He made romantic comedies. He made all kinds of different things. He had range. Yeah. And I think because fundamentally he was such an authentic, you know, sympathetic character with a nice voice that worked well when the movies, you know, moved into talkies, he just became one of the biggest stars in Hollywood almost overnight.
There's a moment that you talk about that in a, it was a silent film actually, called Wings. That it, and it's a very short part. It's a bit part in some ways, but he had such a presence. And you quote the actor Tom Hanks talking about his presence and what he did. Would you just say something about that? I found that really fascinating.
It is a minute and a half.
Yeah,
and he is he's an air cadet, and they're in a camp, and the two protagonists, guys who, you know, stars of the movie, come in and they share a tent. And he wakes up, you know, and he gets up. He says, oh, I'm going to be late. I've got to head out. He puts on his coat, puts on his various clothing, takes out a little chocolate bar, offers him a bit. They wish him good luck. And he looks at them and gives them this kind of wry smile and says, well, luck's fine. But when your number's up, it's up. Heads out the door. And the next thing we know, he's been killed in an air crash. But just that minute and a half, that sort of twinkle in the eye, but that fatalistic sort of grin that comes out of it is just so charming and authentic that it just steals the first half of the movie. And not only Tom Hanks, but many others, performers over the years. Cooper seems to be not acting. He seems to be just being himself. It's naturalistic to the extreme. It's minimalist to the extreme. But it works really well on the big screen. And in a way, not having been, say, a stage actor where you're emoting and you're trying to reach, you know, the folks in the back aisles, knowing that it's the camera and that you're always in the camera's always in the front row, it gave him, you know, his naturalness just shines through, and not only in Wings, but in movie after movie. Made some wonderful movies with Frank Capra later on, did some other things that just really show this. They exude authenticity, the kind of thing you can't fake.
Glenn Frankel is with us. He's a writer, a veteran journalist. His book is called High Noon, The Hollywood Blacklist and the Making of an American Classic. We'll take a quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the story behind the movie classic High Noon, which is a Western, I guess. Stars Gary Cooper as the sheriff doing his duty, waiting for a showdown, hoping that someone in town will help, but knowing that he'll go through it either way. And what's interesting about it is the film comes as the country is gripped with fear about communists. The House Committee on Un-American Activities is asking Hollywood to name names. And High Noon becomes this parable of the time. The journalist Glenn Frankel is joining us to talk about this story. His book is called High Noon, The Hollywood Blacklist and the Making of an American Classic. He's joining us from his home in Arlington, Virginia. Let's talk about another important player. You referred to him earlier, Carl Foreman, who writes the screenplay. Talk a little bit about who he is. He arrives in Los Angeles, too. He arrives broke, but he has to turn tail, really, and go back to Chicago, where he lived. Makes it eventually, but say something about his sense of drama and kind of his radicalism, which you say started pretty young.
Well, Carl, like a lot of the protagonists in this book, is the son of immigrants, Russian Jewish immigrants who come around the turn of the century. They settle in Chicago, live in a, you know, big apartment with a lot of the family floating around, including his grandmother and many others. There's a lot of socialism and some radicalism in the family, and Carl inherits that. He grows up and reaches maturity in the 30s, which is the time of the Great Depression. and the capitalist system was beginning to crumble around the edges. And so a lot of young intellectual folks are looking for solutions, and the American Communist Party seems to offer an idealistic program, anti-fascist, anti-racist, looking out, you know, social democracy in many ways, helping people who are starving. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a natural fit, not only for him, but for many other young intellectuals. And of course, this is a time when Hollywood is is really dominant in our popular culture. And so talented young people flock there. Yeah. Some of them want to be actors. Some of them want to be writers. I mean, you get the great writers, you know, people like F. Scott Fitzgerald and Dorothy Parker go there to make big money and also have aspirations. But a lot of young people start out there as well. And you're right, it takes Carl quite a while to succeed. I mean, he makes some low-budget movies. He's actually losing money for a long time.
Right.
But gradually, he works his way through the system. During the war, he serves on the Army's documentary film unit, where he learns a lot about both writing and the way films are made, and meets a number of other talented young people, including a young guy named Stanley Kramer, who's mm-hmm. also spent some time in Hollywood and who is a very ambitious guy. And they see eye to eye, A, that the studio system is a mess and they're not interested in, you know, making old-fashioned movies, but they are interested in what they can do with films to make socially important, powerful films. And they get together after the war and get started on it.
Let's talk about where the idea for High Noon comes. You write that a United Nations representative approached Stanley Kramer's company, wanted to do a movie about the UN. Now, Carl Foreman liked the idea of the UN, but here's what you write in your book. You say, but rather than turn out a propaganda film, Foreman started playing with the idea of setting it in the Old West, in a town under threat from outside forces. Talk a little bit about the beginnings of this idea.
Yeah, it's partly that he sees this as, you know, following the UN, of course, is the ultimate answer to fascism, to see that fascism doesn't rise again. It involves international cooperation and people coming together to oppose evil, to oppose oppression. And so he wants to set that in the Old West and have some folks come together. It's never clear to me exactly what that script would have looked like. The other thing he wanted to do, his other aspiration, besides to make this kind of anti-fascist Western, if you will, is to make a movie in real time. He's been fascinated by the power and the suspense that real time can offer you. So he's thinking he'll try to set it to a clock and have about 88 minutes going on there. So that's where he gets started. But as time goes on, of course, the political meaning that he's thinking about changes dramatically, because we're moving into that era of the Red Scare, of the Hollywood blacklist. And so the movie begins to take on a much different coloration. And the idea of a community knitting itself together to oppose oppression changes dramatically as well, as Carl finds out that the community that he's in, Hollywood, is not standing up to the new oppression. And so the movie, High Noon, takes on a whole different meaning quite quickly by, say, the end of the 1940s.
It's interesting that, as it turns out, the idea wasn't exactly original. He finds out there's a short story that I think it was a Collier's that had a similar plot.
Yes, that's right. He writes a couple of page treatment and he shows it around the little independent film company that he and Kramer have.
Yeah.
And somebody says, hey, that sounds vaguely familiar. I think I read something. So he goes back, and to his chagrin and embarrassment, he finds out that there is a short story called The Tin Star that ran in Collier's in late 1947, I believe. So Carl then goes out and buys the rights to that short story. It has some of the same names in it, and it has some similar resonance in that it's an old marshal facing bad guys coming to town, but he's got a loyal deputy, and it's more of a story of the passage of the torch from one generation to the next. And that's the theme, really, that it's about. And of course, when Carl gets hold of it, he changes that dramatically. It's no longer a generational story. It's about betrayal, and it's about, you know, a community that doesn't stand up and why it doesn't. So the kernel of the idea comes from The Tin Star, but the movie is very, very different.
There's a big question, and I don't think it's even been resolved to this day. The question is, Who's responsible for this? You say basically that Stanley Kramer is responsible and Carl Foreman's responsible and Fred Zinnemann's responsible. There, I mean, there are a number of people that collaborated, but there's always been this dispute, certainly between Kramer and Foreman, as to who was the one who pulled off this classic film.
Well, it's not unusual in Hollywood, Doug, as you may know, for people to take credit when, you know, when a movie comes along and surprises everyone.
Right,
and
which this did. Yeah.
That's the standard procedure. But I think the disputes in this case, the conflicts, are even more bitter because of the political overtones and because these folks fell out over politics. So, you know, what happens is that when Carl leaves the movie, he's forced off the movie eventually, and, mm-hmm. and Fred Zinnemann, the director, turns in his director's cut. The movie seems to be less suspenseful than they had planned, than they had hoped. And Kramer, who hasn't really been involved in the film up to that point, decides it needs a lot of editing. There's a dispute over whether he did the editing or whether Elmo Williams, mm-hmm. Who was the editor on the film, the official editor, how much he did. There's a dispute over when the clocks were added to the film. Kramer and Williams both claim they added a lot of clocks, which, you know, but that's a little hard to credit because, you know, as it was filmed, you see the actors in various scenes looking up toward the clocks. And so, and they weren't reshot. So, you know, there's a question, who gets credit for the wonderful editing of the film and for the terse, suspenseful nature of it? Who gets credit for adding the wonderful song, Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling? Whose idea that was? Again, Kramer takes credit. Elmo Williams takes credit. I suspect the guy who wrote the song, Dmitri Tiomkin, who comes up with the melody, and Ned Washington, who writes the lyrics, I think, that, you know, they may deserve most of the credit. Anyway, in going through it, it was fascinating to look at old interviews with these guys. I found a few that had never been transcribed. I came to the conclusion that they all were responsible.
Yeah.
That High Noon really is a great collaboration. It's a wonderful script from Carl Foreman. It's directed in a gritty sort of documentary black and white style that is totally Fred Zinnemann's, you know, mm-hmm. M.O., he and his cameraman Floyd Crosby. Elmo Williams did do a wonderful job of film editing, and perhaps Stanley got involved in that too. I'm really not sure about that, but Elmo Williams was a very good film editor. And of course, the wonderful song. I think Stanley gets credit for having thought of the idea, but then Tiomkin and the gang did that. So this is a very talented group of people making an excellent movie. And my book is about how they did it, but also about how their little, you know, this little enterprise they had was really crushed and destroyed in many ways by the blacklist.
Yeah. It's interesting. Before we head to a break, I wanted to have you see if you could explain why you think it worked as a film, why it was successful. Everyone seemed to be, certainly the people in the, you know, the Kramer's company, they were surprised by it. They didn't think it was going to be so successful. But you say that it was, you know, it was so austere, and as a Western, sort of a Western, but as you mentioned, there were no grand vistas, there were no cattle drives, there weren't any Indian attacks, no gunplay really at all, of course, until that last showdown. It's compact, it's taut, is how you put it. Why did it work, do you think, for 1952?
That's a really good question. I should add, the performances were wonderful, starting with Cooper, yeah, who gives the performance of his life and wins the Academy Award later. But also the supporting cast that Carl and Stanley put together were, you know, for very little money. And, you know, they were bringing in people for a couple of days and then bringing them out again. Yeah. Grace Kelly is wonderful. Katia Jurado, the two women in the movie are terrific. So it's partly that adds to it. But, you know, in thinking about this, it's not hard to see why it made money and did well right away, because it had all the right elements. And Cooper brings an authenticity that brands it as a Western, even though the other guys involved had never made a Western before. There's all of that. But I think the reason it endures is largely because of the heroism and the courage that the marshal shows, but it's reluctant heroism and courage. Mm. He doesn't want to face these four killers by himself. He thinks he can get the moral support of his community and his friends to back him as they'd done previously. And he finds, you know, to his great chagrin, that they're not there. It's, as you said earlier in our talk, the journey that he goes on to discover that no one's going to stand with him. So he'd love to get out of town. He'd love to take his beautiful new bride, get on that wagon, and get the hell out of Dodge. but he can't.
Yeah.
And he can't really articulate to us why that is, but you see it in his face. You see the vulnerability. He knows he could die. He doesn't want to be a martyr, but he doesn't feel he has any choice. And I think that's a universal lesson, if you will, that has universal appeal, especially to Americans, that sense of reluctant heroism. There's no superheroes here. There's no one who's going to pull out a laser beam and shoot dead all the stormtroopers.
Yeah.
It's one guy who wants to get out of town but has to stand tall. It's partly pride, I think, but it's partly a moral code that he lives by, and he will not betray in spite of all of the pressures on him.
Let me play a moment from the film. I like it. You write about how the roles of women in the film, you mentioned Grace Kelly and Katy Jurado also, they didn't really fit into conventional models in some ways. And I really liked this part of the book where you talk about how the roles for women in this film were interesting. And I want to play this moment where Katy Jurado plays Helen Ramirez. And there's this moment between her and the Lloyd Bridge character where she talks about this moment of how the community is dying because no one will come to his aid. Let me play this moment and we can talk about it.
Let me tell you something. You're not going anywhere. You're staying here with me. It's going to be just like it was before.
You want to know why I'm leaving? Then listen. Cain will be a dead man in half an hour, and nobody's going to do anything about it. And when he dies, this town dies too. I can feel it. I am all alone in the world. I have to make a living. So I'm going someplace else. That's all.
You say Helen better than anyone understands the stakes here. And that what, Glenn Frankel? That it's about the sense of the community.
That's right, that the community is fundamentally, there's a moral rot at the core of the community. She talks about how much she's hated this town in an earlier moment. It's to be a Mexican woman in this town. Actually, she says that to the Grace Kelly character a bit later. So she understands, she's the only one in town who really understands the marshal, Will Cain, and understands why he's doing the things he has to do. And she wants to support him. She used to be his mistress. But he broke up with her more than a year earlier. So she's angry at him. She has a, you know, she says she's got a conflict with him. But at the same time, she's the only one who really gets it. And she wants to help him. But in the end, she can't. And she won't risk her own life to do that. So she leaves town.
Yeah.
Very unusual. Very strong woman. Knows what she wants. Knows who she believes in and who she doesn't. You know, often in these old westerns, the dark-skinned mistress of the hero takes a bullet in the third reel, and the hero then rides off with the beautiful white woman, or, you know. But Helen Ramirez isn't taking a bullet for anyone.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, she's going to do what she has to do to survive. So when the showdown comes, she's on the train getting out of town.
That's Glenn Frankel. His book is High Noon, The Hollywood Blacklist and the Making of an American Classic. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Glenn Frankel. We're talking about his book, High Noon, The Hollywood Blacklist and the Making of an American Classic. So when the film comes out, initial screenings, they did some sneak peeks of the film, and they didn't think it was going to work at all. But it does. And we talked a little bit about the reaction. It becomes quite successful. But I wonder, did anyone get the political allegory? Was anyone talking about that at the time?
That's a really good question as well. Bosley Crowther, the New York Times film critic, was one of the guys who really delivered on High Noon, if you will. He wrote a wonderful review, helped it get started in New York. And about a week after the original review, he writes a Sunday piece that mentions the marshal and his courage. And he does have a line in there that says, you know, there are people in Hollywood who could learn a lesson about courage from him.
Right.
So that's kind of a slightly indirect, you know, look at it. There's an editorial writer for The Nation magazine, the left-wing New York-based magazine, a few months later writes an article that directly links the two. But by and large, nobody really gets it. It's just considered a really kind of good Western with Gary Cooper. There are some people in Hollywood, including the great John Wayne, who sort of smell out the sort of leftist critique in the movie. But that's more, you know, Wayne's not a great film critic. What he does is he just draws certain conclusions. Carl Foreman used to be in the Communist Party. Yeah. Carl Foreman refuses to cooperate with the committee. Yeah. Carl Foreman wrote High Noon. Therefore, High Noon must be a communist, you know, movie. So Wayne denounces it early on and later says it's the most un-American thing he's ever seen. But generally, it got a pass. And part of that is Cooper. He was a member of Hollywood royalty. He was a strong anti-communist. In the end, people weren't going to accuse Gary Cooper of putting out some left-wing propaganda.
It's so interesting that John Wayne accepts Gary Cooper was away shooting a film. He didn't come in to accept his Oscar. He has John Wayne do it for him. Which is kind of ironic in a way, although I guess, as you say, it wasn't clear to everyone that that this was a political parable or an allegory at the time. But I thought it was interesting how much John Wayne hated, for example, the way it portrayed churchgoers and public officials as cowards and hypocrites. For as much as he hated the film, it was just, I guess, kind of an ironic twist that he accepts the Oscar for Gary Cooper.
Ironic, paradoxical. I mean, the Oscars, Doug, I'm not telling you anything you don't already know, can be very political.
Yeah.
And so Carl Foreman, who was nominated for Best Screenplay, there was no way he was going to win. There was no way the movie was going to be the Best Picture. But Cooper is Hollywood royalty, and he won, and people were very happy about that. And Wayne, who was a little younger than Cooper and a deferential man to his elders, when Cooper asks him to go get it, he agrees that he'll do it. And he gives a very gracious speech, and he even pretends that he wished his guys had brought the High Noon script to him.
Right.
And he's going to go out the next day, he claims, and, you know, have a talk with them about why Cooper got this role and he didn't. Well, you know, that's just all fantasy, but it's Wayne being, you know, gracious. And Wayne, very dashing, handsome man in 1953 when the Oscars were, you know, ceremony was done. You know, he's playing a role there.
Yeah.
His true beliefs about High Noon are very clear and very negative.
Was anyone rooting for Carl Foreman to win an Oscar for High Noon?
Not really. Probably Fred Zinnemann and, you know, a handful of others. But no, there was an underground campaign to make sure Carl didn't win. Hedda Hopper denounced the film in her columns. There's a man who was working for Paramount. You know, the studios each had their sort of blacklist enforcers, and one of them at Paramount, who actually was sending reports occasionally to a CIA contact, writes him in early 53 about the campaign to make sure that Foreman doesn't win. Carl, by that point, had left the country, had gone to London, was starting to write scripts under pseudonyms, because that's the only way he could get paid. And he's sitting there when this happens, and, you know, the High Noon wins 4 Oscars, and nobody ever mentions the guy who had the first idea and the guy who really and wrote the script. It's like the thing wrote itself. Carl's never mentioned once, and he's sitting there and angry and hurt and alienated, and life goes on without him, as it did with so many of these folks.
There's another great character we should mention during all of this, by the name of Martin Berkeley. Becomes an informer, kind of a distasteful character, I have to say, in the scheme of things. Talk about where he fits.
Well, you know, in writing about Carl, and I think the reluctant courage that he showed in standing up to the committee and refusing to cooperate, I was kind of interested in also writing about some of the folks who'd taken the other position. And I write about several of them, I think, with some sympathy. But Martin was interesting. He, like Carl, was a screenwriter. He, like Carl, had been in the Communist Party and had left in the early 1940s. And when he is named as someone who'd been in the party, first he denies it, but then he realizes they've got the goods on him. They've got his old party card. He was at the first big meeting of the party in the late 30s was held in Hollywood at his house. So he goes the full Monty, the other route. And rather than refuse to cooperate, he decides to name everybody. And he gets on the stand in September 1951 and names more than 150 people, including Carl. And Martin tries to use his testimony and his new stature, if you will, as the biggest anti-communist, to get film writing gigs. He goes on a speaking tour for the American Legion. He's just decided that this is the way to go. He didn't like, at that point, he definitely was a strong anti-communist. So there is, you know, a foundation of philosophical disagreement, hatred, really, on his part. But he exploits this all he can to try to, you know, become a celebrity and become successful. It doesn't really work for him in the end. But I thought he was a really fascinating character. For the others, for many of the others who named names, you know, it was a choice of keeping your job, of being able to work, or of supporting your friends, of going down, you know, on the ship and being blacklisted. And it's not, there's no good choice here. There's nothing you can do that's going to rescue either your conscience, you know, or your job. And so I had a good deal of sympathy for a lot of these folks. I asked myself the question that history always asks us, you know, if you were in that position, what would you do? And it's a hard question to answer.
The blacklist finally fades away, but it takes a while. I think it took longer than people expected. And you write about the rise of Joseph McCarthy, for example, how reckless he was. That helped undo the blacklists and this idea that the judiciary finally steps in and starts to do things. You also mentioned the rise of John F. Kennedy. That started to calm some of the country's anxieties.
Yeah, I think Eisenhower himself, Kennedy's predecessor, had a role in calming things down, and he certainly had a role in undermining McCarthy and censuring him in 54. So, but the Cold War is still going strong, and the communist threat is still very, very large. Over time, some courageous people, including, I should say, Stanley Kramer, hired some of the blacklisted writers to do some work. Otto Preminger with the movie Exodus and Kirk Douglas with Spartacus both hired Dalton Trumbo, one of the original Hollywood Tens, and give him his name on the screenplays. So gradually the blacklist is eroded. And a key moment is when President Kennedy, just after his election, decides to go to the movies. He goes to the Warner Theater three blocks from the White House. His Secret Service team drives him there, and he sees Spartacus, written by Dalton Trumbo. And he comes out of there, and they ask him how he liked the movie, the press, and he says, I thought it was a pretty good movie. He doesn't mention the blacklist. He doesn't mention Trumbo. The reporters don't ask him. But in a way, that was a real nail in the coffin of the blacklist, I mean. But at the same time, it took many, many, many years for a lot of people, you know, right into the mid-60s, for some people to get their jobs back. The actress Lee Grant couldn't get work till the early 60s. Many others. The blacklist hung in there hard for a long time. What I thought, and it's related in the sense that, you know, when Carl Foreman is writing scripts from London, he and another blacklisted writer named Michael Wilson in 1958 write the script for The Bridge on the River Kwai. Yeah. And it's a huge hit, and it wins the Oscar for Best Screenplay. But Carl and Michael don't get the credit because their names are not on the movie because they're blacklisted. And they only get their Oscars 26 years later, when the Motion Picture Academy, after investigating this thoroughly, awards the two Academy Awards, and the people who come to pick them up at the ceremony are Carl and Michael's widows, because both of the men have passed away long before. And that, you know, that kind of blow, that sense of, you know, being denied your work and being denied to put your name on your work was one of the most bitter and emotional parts of this whole process. And that lasted a long time. And the scars from that, I think you can still see in Hollywood.
Yeah. What effect did the blacklist have on journalism? That was another, for many journalists, it wasn't exactly a high point.
No, it wasn't. When I mentioned earlier that a lot of our institutions let us down, certainly, you know, our three branches of government and the political parties, but also, you know, journalism,
yeah,
by and large. There were some very brave journalists along the way, and Herb Block, the great political cartoonist, and some good editorials here and there. But by and large, the journalists, and I'm talking about mainstream journalists, played the role of enablers here. The committee would hold a hearing in the morning and accuse a dozen people or more of being communists and go right into the newspaper. And I was surprised to see that, you know, my own alma mater, the Washington Post, which I'm very proud of, and the New York Times, they didn't bother to call up or try to contact the people who were being named. They made no effort, by and large, to see what their response was. If you wanted to get, you know, so if you wanted to clear your name, you then had to go before the committee. They didn't, in other words, they didn't hold the people in power up to be accountable. They didn't ask for the evidence and the proof. They just went ahead uncritically and printed whatever the committee put out for them. And I hope that's changed. I mean, I think one of the lessons here, one of the surprises for me, too, in studying that era, was how fragile our democracy can be in times of stress, and how it let us down in the sense of civil liberties at that time. And frankly, Doug, I think we're in another era where our democracy is under great stress. And the question is, how are the various institutions, or, you know, not only government institutions, but non-government ones, who's going to stand up now and who's going to defend democracy? I think the press is doing a better job these days, but the verdict's still out, and the fate of our democracy is still in many ways up for grabs.
Final thought. I think it's interesting that you talk about how High Noon has become part of the political journalistic lexicon now. It's kind of interesting to hear that it's the most requested film by American presidents these days.
Yes, it's true. Dwight Eisenhower loved it, and I think he screened it 3 times in the White House. But Bill Clinton really loved it, screened it something like 17 times. I think there's something about, you know, the White House that makes presidents feel a little lonely sometimes when they face crises and tough decisions. Some of their political allies sort of back away from them and leave them standing on their own. And again, that gets back to this thing about the reluctant courage of High Noon, and even when you're on your own and you don't have your allies, you know, trying to do the right thing. That's the basic appeal of the movie, and I think that's the basic appeal for people under stress, whether they're the presidents or, you know, or screenwriters or politicians. What are you going to do when the clock strikes High Noon? Where are you going to stand?
It's Glenn Frankel. His book is High Noon, The Hollywood Blacklist and the Making of an American Classic. Joined us from his home in Arlington, Virginia. Glenn Frankel, thank you very much for taking the time.
Well, Doug, thanks for having me. This was great.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction today from Michael Havey. Our thanks to Melody Rowell. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.
Do not forsake me, oh my darling, on this hour.